Sorry. Okay, so I'm going to talk now, as I said, about a particular kind of technical issue about deflationism and its presentation. It's not super technical. It's not masses of mathematical logic. It's a kind of technical objection in the sense of Higginbotham's law. Have you come across Higginbotham's law? There's no reason why you should have done. So Higginbotham was, until he died recently, this kind of fantastic philosopher of language who kind of spent his career dealing with problems for a particular program. So anyone who read the Horridge piece, you may have noted in passing that Horridge talks about Davidson's views about meaning. And Davidson's proposal was to give an account of meaning by appeal to truth conditions, give an account of truth conditions by appeal to kind of formal machinery presented in Tarski's account of truth. And this raises various difficulties. So, for example, very difficult to see how to give an account of propositional attitude attributions in this way, because propositional attitude attributions look like they make appeal to senses in addition to reference, and yet the truth conditional account looks like it can only appeal to references. So anyway, blah, blah, blah. Higginbotham spent his career solving problems of this kind. So for any putative problem for Davidson's account, Higginbotham would go to his office for half an hour and come up with a solution. So Higginbotham's law, I think, was propounded by Jerry Fodor in honour of this power of Higginbotham's. And it just says, for any technical problem, there's a technical solution. So these are technical issues in that there might well be ways of fixing them. The reason I present them is in part for their intrinsic interest and in part because I guess I have a sense that the specific problems that I'm going to talk about tie up with some of those more general and amorphous concerns I mentioned at the end of the previous lecture. But I'll try and say something about that as we go through. So the problem here is raised by so-called truth value gaps. So although some sentences appear to be true or false, others might be held not to possess truth values and have been held not to possess truth values by at least some philosophers and indeed by at least some ordinary folk, if you count first-year philosophers as ordinary folk. So some people arrive at university with some of these views. Maybe they've been reading air or something. But anyway, so eating meat is wrong. Some philosophers will think that although it's good to say that, it's good to say eating meat is wrong, you don't thereby state any truth. Don't say anything that's true. Don't indeed say anything that's false. Rather, the function of this way of talking, saying things like eating meat is wrong, is something other than stating truths or falsehoods. Perhaps you might put that by saying it's something other than stating facts, characterising how things factually are. Another kind of case, which in a way we'll say much more about when we get on to vagueness, is would be a use of something like that's red, said of a borderline case. So a borderline case would be something, you know, it looks a little bit red and a little bit orange. Okay, and it's not clear whether it's red, it's not clear whether it's orange. It's very difficult to come to a decision about that. It's perhaps impossible to come to a decision about that. If we say of something in that borderline zone, somewhere between, I don't know, what's vaguely red? Somewhere between your kind of jumper and one of these chairs. Okay, you might say your jumper isn't clearly red, chair's clearly red. Somewhere in between there's a kind of borderline. Perhaps your jumper's the borderline. And so that's a nice red jumper. And on this view, I failed to say anything true, failed to say anything false. Really suggested some compliment. And another kind of case would be cases where a singular term's used, in particular something that looks like an ordinary proper name, but where that expression lacks a reference. It fails to pick any real entity out. So you might think that Pegasus is larger than Shergar is such a case. So you might think that Pegasus is an empty expression. It fails to pick anything out. It's part of a fiction rather than part of a way of characterising things that would involve picking that particular item out. I mean, you might want to respond by saying Pegasus does refers to a fictional entity. Right? You might think there are such things as fictional entities, including fictional winged horses. Right? Fine. But if you don't think that, then you might well think that Pegasus is larger than Shergar lacks a truth value. Because it would be natural to give an account of sentences like this in general, on which their truth depends on whether or not the predicative component of the sentence here applies or fails to apply to the thing picked out by the referential component. So this sentence would be true if the thing picked out by Pegasus is correctly characterised as larger than Shergar, and false if the thing picked out by Pegasus bit isn't correctly characterised by being larger than Shergar. Okay? But either of those evaluations as true or false depend on Pegasus picking something out. So if Pegasus doesn't pick anything out, as it's natural to think it doesn't, then the sentence as a whole will fail to be true or false. So if there are any such cases, there are cases of sentences that occupy truth value gaps. Okay? They occupy the gap between the sentences that are true and the sentences that are false. And it's not unnatural to think there might be such cases. So there's a question which is, well, what should the deflationists say about such cases? Minimally, it looks like it's going to be troubling because they're kind of committed to thinking that wherever you have a proposition, or if they're sentential deflationists, whenever you have a meaningful sentence, you're going to be able to state truth conditions for that sentence. From that perspective, it'll look as though the sentence is going to be either true or false. And yet, truth value gap claim suggests that that's wrong. In slightly more detail, the problem, the more kind of significant but, as I've said, technical problem that arises is that the deflationist needs to say something not only about truth, but also about falsehood. So as well as the kind of equivalence schema that we've already looked at, the equivalence schema for truth, it's plausible they need some kind of equivalence schema for negation as well. So they need something to go along with all the instances of the proposition that P is true if and only if P. They need something like the negation equivalence schema, all the instances of the proposition that P is false if and only if the proposition that P is not true. Okay, and if you have the combination of these two claims, that forces you into difficulties with truth value gaps. So let's take some target case and call it Q, and assume, to see how the argument goes, that it's neither true nor false, so it falls into a truth value gap. But now consider the negation equivalence schema. This says the proposition that P is false if and only if the proposition that P is not true. Now, reading right to left, we have that Q is false. So we know that the proposition that P is not true, because that's part of what it is for it to be a truth value gap. But now it seems to follow, given the negation equivalence schema, from its not being true, that it is false. Okay? And that might be something we'd wanted to avoid it. By assumption, it's not false, right? Because it's a truth value gap. It's not true and it's not false. So we get a problem. Okay, it's a problem here. We try and say that the thing's neither true or false, we have to say it's not true, but then if we admit the negation equivalence schema, that forces us into saying it's false. So we've lost the capacity to capture truth value gaps. Things get a little bit worse. Since this truth value gap claim isn't false, we have the negation of the left-hand side of the negation equivalence. Okay, and because we have a biconditional, we also have the negation of the right-hand side. So we have, it's not the case that the proposition that Q is not true. Okay, just making use of it being a truth value gap and a schema. But now we can use double negation elimination to get that Q is true, okay, which again is incompatible with it being a truth value gap, but moreover is incompatible with Q's being false, which we derived from the negation equivalence schema, first place. So all that shows, right, is that one way of dealing with falsehood that looked like it would fit well with the needs of deflationism and the needs of the minimalist account, one way of providing an account of negation runs into trouble with truth value gaps. So there might be other ways of avoiding the difficulty. That's why it's a kind of technical objection. More generally, responsibility for this problem can be traced to at least one of the following components that figured in setting up the issue. Might be traced to the existence of truth value gaps, right? So we might deny there are any such things. We might say, look, any sentence you like that's appropriate to fit into the relevant schema, then that will not be a truth value gap. That would be one reasonable thing to say. That's something that Horwich at least sometimes wants to say. Another thing we might blame would be various bits of classical logic that we used in deriving bits of the problem. So, for example, double negation elimination. We'd have to do some work there, but we might revise the principles of logic we're exploiting that lead us into difficulty here. Okay? Weaken our adherence to them. Or we might blame the negation equivalence schema. The question here is, which should we do? Now, the only specific feature of deflationism that's doing work here seems to be the negation equivalence schema. So it's perhaps most plausible that we should consider rejecting that, or at least that we should reject some instances of it. So we might treat some instances as pathological in something like the way I suggested earlier. But notice first that we need something like the negation equivalence schema in order to have a deflationist account of falsehood. Okay? It'd be natural to think that falsehood is going to connect up with truth in something very close to the way that the negation equivalence schema suggests. Worse, similar problems seem to be derivable just from the equivalence schema. Bless you. Again, consider a truth value gap, putative instance of a truth value gap Q. Since Q isn't true or false, follows that Q isn't true. Hence, the left-hand side of the equivalence schema, right, the thing that says it's true, Q is true, turns out to be false. But the right-hand side is Q, which we're taking it isn't false because it's a truth value gap. So now we have a biconditional with a falsehood on one side and something that's not false on the other. It's a truth value gap. So ordinary treatments, right, the most flat-footed classical logical treatments will make the biconditional false in that case, right? The values of the two sides of the biconditional differ. Left-hand side is true, is false, and the right-hand side is not false. Okay, so classical logical treatment will make the biconditional false. Some mild revisions would make it into a truth value gap. Okay, say that the truth valuelessness of one component means that the whole thing is truth valueless. But in that case, again, we seem to have to give up the key deflationist idea that the notion of truth is fixed by the truth of all instances of the equivalence schema, since not all of them are going to be true. There's going to be a bunch of cases where the equivalence schema fails to apply. And moreover, and this is something that Horwich stresses himself, we appear to need every instance of the equivalence schema in order to subserve the deflationist account of the function of truth via generalisation. Right. I mean, very crudely, when I try and say that endorse everything that Bill says, right? When I try and generalise in order to endorse everything Bill says, I end up saying everything Bill says is true. It looks as though when I make that attempt, I wasn't attempting to avoid play with the truth value gaps, right? It might well be, for example, that amongst the things Bill said was that eating meat is wrong. And I very much wanted to endorse that. It might have been Bill's moral views about vegetarianism that induced my trust in him in the first place, right? It might be those are the things I particularly want to endorse. So there's a kind of difficulty here. Now, as I've said, one thing one might try doing is giving up on the existence of truth value gaps, and that might be okay. But a related kind of move that's perhaps less drastic would be to try and say the following. What we have here is truth value gaps, but they're, so to speak, sentential truth value gaps. You've got sentences that fail to have truth values. But the reason they fail to have truth values is because they fail to express propositions. Propositions are, say, the only or the fundamental truth bearers. So if you don't have propositions, you don't have a truth bearer, so you have a truth value gap. So you say in this case that the truth value gaps arise because the sentences in question precisely fail to express propositions. And moreover, you say, naturally enough, you emphasise that minimalism only applies to propositions, right? So minimalism can retain its absolute generality. It's just that its generality covers only propositions. It doesn't cover sentences that fail to express propositions. So I think the natural, as that kind of move is, it makes vivid the earlier issue that I was sketching at a slightly more general level. So now it looks as though in order to tell whether a sentence expresses a proposition in the required way, one needs some way of checking that it's not a truth value gap. Okay, because if it's a truth value gap, then in order to fit the rest of the account, it better not express a proposition. So unless it's possible to tell whether or not something's a truth value gap independently of exploiting our facility with the concept of truth, then again, we'll lose the deflationist order of explanation from propositions or sentences expressing propositions to truth as a free addition to that basic schema. So that's the kind of way in which this technical issue can potentially feed into the more general issues about deflationism. Okay, so as I've said, none of that raises, I think, decisive objections on its own to deflationism, but at least suggests some routes through which one might want to present deflationists with challenges. Consider what kinds of things they can say in response, how different their view is liable to look depending on how they respond to those challenges. So, for example, by revising the negation equivalence schema. Does that make for some weirdly unexplained asymmetry between the treatment of truth and the treatment of falsehood, for example? We're going to move on now from deflationism to some issues surrounding truth and paradox, and in particular the liar paradox. You see ways in which this topic connects up with the previous one, in particular through the way in which generating the liar paradox typically makes use of analogues of the platitudes governing truth, something like the kinds of equivalence schema that figure in deflationism and other views of truth. Okay, so first questions here concern paradox in general. I just want to say this is a kind of definitional of technical terms in a way. The way I think about paradoxes is something like the following. So first I want to say what paradox is as I understand it, and then I want to say something about what an adequate response to a paradox might look like. So a paradox is a set of sentences or propositions with the following properties. First up, all the propositions at least appear to be true. All the propositions in the set appear to be true, least to initial untutored inspection. Second, the propositions can be shown to be inconsistent or not possibly all true by some form or forms of reasoning. Okay, so one can start with the propositions that each individually appear to be true and then operate on those by some form or forms of reasoning in order to generate a claim that these propositions can't all be true together. And third, the forms of reasoning involved in generating that appearance of inconsistency all appear to be impeccable. Right? They all look like good forms of reasoning. Again, at least to untutored inspection. So here's a kind of example that some of you will have come across before. Set of propositions. Proposition one, there is freedom of the will. Proposition two, freedom of the will is incompatible with the truth of determinism. Proposition three, determinism is true. Well, and with some kind of narrative patter, each of these propositions can be made to seem plausible. Okay? And then it looks as though with some fairly basic forms of impeccable seeming reasoning, one can fairly straightforwardly come to see the appearance that these propositions can't all be true together, right? Which may well be of ridicule appearance, may be right that they can't all be true together. So depending on how the propositions are spelled out, each of those propositions is apt to appear plausible, and certainly work would be required to remove their individual patina of plausibility to make them seem less plausible than they do to initial inspection. And a very elementary form of reasoning in this case can be used to show that it's impossible for all of those three propositions to be true together. Right? Since the second claim seems to be that the first and the third claims are incompatible. So our options in the face of that kind of circumstance, this kind of pattern of appearances, propositions that appear true, forms of reasoning that appear impeccable, working together to generate a conclusion that appears absolutely unacceptable, kind of contradiction, gives us an array of kinds of options. So one kind of option would be to reject at least one of the propositions. Okay, if you reject one of the propositions and you need all of the propositions to generate the problem, then that will resolve the problem. Another kind of option would be to reject the more or less elementary forms of reasoning that are employed in deriving the claim that it's not the case that all three of them can be true together. Okay, so one might reject that. Right, in the case I gave you, that would be kind of really implausible, but there might be other cases where that's the right thing to do. Right, if the argument to incompatibility had crucially involved double negation elimination, then we might think that there's some plausibility in considering giving up double negation elimination. Okay? So that might be an option in some cases. A third option would be to try and find a way in which what appeared obviously false or unacceptable, the joint truth of the propositions and the correctness of the form of reasoning, can be seen to be acceptable. But, I mean, one extreme way there would be to say, oh yeah, what you've done there is taken three true propositions and made use of absolutely impeccable forms of reasoning to derive a contradiction, so we've definitely got a contradiction, but who's to say you can't have true contradictions or acceptable contradictions? Okay. So although, you know, so the naive person might think that it would be a bad thing to end up with a contradictory position, but there are theorists who think that that's just a mistake. There's an appearance that contradictions can't be accepted, but we can get past that appearance. Okay? So that would be one kind of way of reacting this third type of way. So those are your basic options in the face of a paradox. Right? Reject at least one of the propositions that make up the paradox, reject at least one of the forms of reasoning that figure in generating the paradox, or find a way of living with the problematic conclusion. Okay, so there's a kind of minimal condition here on resolving the paradox, which is given these options, assigning blame to at least one of the relevant targets. But there are further conditions of adequacy here that we might want to consider. So, in ascending order of strength, what I've just said, a minimal solution would have to assign blame in such a way that the inconsistency or obvious falsehood is no longer generated. I have to find a way of pointing the finger and explaining how pointing the finger in that direction enables us to avoid whatever we found problematic in the setup of the paradox. Okay, so perhaps, for example, say what was to blame was the claim that we have freedom. Okay, that was just a kind of an illusion. It's an illusion to think that we're free, so we drop that, and now at least we no longer have an inconsistency in our thinking about human freedom. Slightly more demanding, but slightly better kind of solution would involve, in addition, explaining why that chosen assignment of blame is better than alternative assignments of blame. It's one thing to point the finger, it's another to explain why pointing the finger in that direction rather than other directions is to be preferred. Okay, so why is it that it's better to give up on human freedom than it is, for example, to give up on determinism? Right, what favours one reaction over the other? Be good, if one can, to meet this condition. More demanding still, and plausibly superior, would be to explain why the element at which blame's assigned might appear to be correct, despite being in fact incorrect, and thereby to help diagnose the appearance of correctness. Right? So you want to explain. So someone thought that humans had freedom. Right, your reaction to the paradox is to reject that. You think we're not free. It'd be good if you could explain why people are subject to this illusion. Why are people subject to the illusion of thinking themselves free when in fact they're not free? That would help to make more robust one's reaction to the paradox. And connected with making one's reaction to the paradox more robust, be a fourth and most extreme kind of adequacy condition on a reaction to paradox. I don't know of any case where this condition has been met. The best response to a paradox would be one that was such that, at least after kind of extended reflection, it removed the patina of plausibility from the blamed element so that it no longer even appeared to be plausible. Right, so you've got yourself in a position where once you've realised what was tricking people into being misled, into thinking that we have freedom or what have you, you're able to uncover ways of training people not to be tricked. Right? Training people not to be misled so that when people are presented in the future, been so successful as a philosopher that in the future, when people are presented with this seeming, what now seems to us to be a paradox, they'll just say, oh, obviously, humans lack freedom, for example. And this is more common. I understand this is actually fairly common amongst mathematicians. I don't know if this is something. I mean, not about paradoxes, but about cases where you get some surprising finding. So at one stage, there's a finding that's surprising, and everyone's like, geez, that can't be right. Everyone does the checks.
So
and
then, I've actually got an interesting anecdote about this at a seminar I was at yesterday. Somebody noted some vague mathematical logical statements, and he said, well, I've talked to very many clever sectors about this, and some of them think it's obviously true, and others think it's obviously false. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite easy to convince mathematicians that something is obvious, but mm-hmm. maybe they're a bit quick to
yeah, but
that.
Obviousness is interesting. Obviousness manifests. There's a G.H. Hardy story in the same kind of mould where he's doing this talk. So everyone come across Hardy. He's a very famous mathematician from the sort of early to mid 20th century, Cambridge, and he wrote about mathematical experience and stuff and his experience of being a mathematician. But there's an anecdote about him where he was giving a talk to some room of mathematicians, and he said, you know, he does the usual thing. He's presenting a proof or something. Step 3, obvious. Hands up. I don't think that's obvious.
So Hardy starts thinking, gets all kind of worried, leaves the room, wanders up and down the corridor for, I don't know, 30 minutes or something, then comes back in the room and says, okay, it's obvious.
So it's that kind of effect, right? But the idea is that, ideally, right, it would be great if one could go as far as getting past even the feeling of part of the paradox that you want to give up being plausible. Okay. So that's just some general reflections on what one might hope for here. And we're not going to get anything close to, I guess, any of those adequacy conditions, but that's what ultimately we'd like. So we're going to be talking first off about the liar paradox. We'll talk about a slightly different paradox afterwards when we come to talk about vagueness. So the liar paradox is so called because its original form was supposed to involve a Cretan, Epimenides, who uttered something like liar one, this sentence, all Cretans always lie. Okay. Now, on certain assumptions, so we have to make certain assumptions to get this case to flow. We have to assume that all other Cretans always lie. We have to assume that everything else that this particular Cretan said is a lie. And we have to assume that something's a lie just in case it's false. Right, which is actually not true, right? One can express falsehoods without lying, I think, and one can perhaps lie without expressing falsehoods. But suppose all of those things, then we can run an initial version of a liar paradox, and it goes like this. So premise one, kind of assumption, this liar one sentence, all Cretans always lie, is either true or it's false. Another assumption is that that sentence, liar one, isn't both true and false. And those seem like kind of reasonable background assumptions. And now we have that liar one, this sentence, is identical with all Cretans always lie. And that's just generated by the way we set the case up, right? That looks like just part of the description of the case. Now, from the truth schema, from the kind of equivalent schema that we've been making play with in talking about deflationism and the like, we have that the sentence, all Cretans always lie, is true if and only if all Cretans always lie. Which is, like, pretty plausible. That's supposed to be, I guess, amongst the platitudes. So now we have that liar one, that sentence, is true if and only if all Cretans always lie, right? Just by replacing liar one with this, with which it's identical according to earlier premise. But now, all Cretans always lie, just in case liar one, this sentence, is false, from the definition of lying and the initial case setup. Given the earlier assumptions, if all Cretans always lie, then this particular sentence uttered by this Cretan had better be a falsehood. So liar one is true if and only if liar one is false. Okay, again by transitivity here of if and only if. So suppose that liar one's true, then it will turn out to be false by one direction of the biconditional. Suppose that liar one's false, then it will be true by the other direction of the biconditional. So if liar one is either true or false, then it's both true and false. So if one is true, then two is false. Okay, that's a version of kind of liar paradox. So we get what seems to be an inconsistency, something unacceptable, from benign assumptions to get seemingly benign assumptions, plausible assumptions, together with the initial setup of the case. That's the kind of thing that one struggles with when one struggles with the liar paradox. I'm running out of coffee. Okay, so the main operative elements in this form of the liar paradox are, first off, the assumption that the liar one sentence is either true or false, so some form of bivalence, but also that it's not both true and false, so some form of denial of contradictions. some basic forms of classical reasoning, didn't use anything especially funky in generating the derivation, used basic principles governing conditionals and the like. And we had the initial case set up, including the idea that aside from this case, Cretans always speak falsely. Looks like the kind of thing that in principle could be possible. Didn't look to be anything especially incoherent or inconceivable in the case setup. And then the fourth thing that seems to figure in generation of the case is application of the T-schema to this particular case. Application of the general schema that a sentence is true, if and only if, and then the sentence is repeated. So it's not straightforward, right, to see where to point the finger if that's all that's going on in generating the difficulty. And we've seen that an adequate response to this first version of the liar paradox has to minimally assign blame, has to say which of those operative elements should be rejected, which is responsible for the problem and should be given up. Ideally, given that we're philosophers rather than journalists, we'd like to justify that assignment of blame. We'd like to say something about why that's the right bit of the problem case to reject. And going further still, it would be nice if we could explain both why the relevant element seemed plausible and help people to get past that appearance, that patina of plausibility. Now, that first version of the paradox has very special features, right? The role of all the other Cretans and all that stuff. The nature of lying and the like. So with the aim of trying to isolate the absolutely minimal components, the minimal operative elements driving the paradox, it's now usual to focus on a slightly different form of the paradox, much more minimal, cleaned up form of the paradox, forms of the paradox. So here's the kind of case that people typically focus on nowadays. So let the following be sentence one. So sentence one is not true. That could be sentence one is false. Okay? We could have used other ways of talking about that sentence. So this sentence is not true. The first numbered sentence on whatever slide this is not true, and so forth. So suppose you've got that as your example. Now we can construct the paradoxical derivation in the following way. Okay, so we've got sentence one is not true, is true if and only if sentence one is not true by direct application of T-schema. Premise two is just that sentence one, right, that name, sentence one, the thing named there, is identical with this expanded version. Sentence one is not true. And that seems just to be a feature of the initial case setup. That's a feature of the example that we presented. But now we have that sentence one is true if and only if sentence one is not true from those two premises by substitution of identicals, right? By replacing sentence one with sentence one is not true, vice versa. So now we have that sentence one is true and sentence one is not true from bivalence and this conclusion. So assume that the thing's true, conditional will generate that it's false. Assume that it's not true, conditional will generate that it's true. So it's both. So we've got a contradiction. From very, very simple starting points, right? Just the basic case we set up as generating P2 and the equivalent schema in application to this case, so premise one, and the logical machinery we made use of, which is fairly straightforward. So in this case, the two main operative elements appear to be premise one and premise two. So natural to think, it appears that at least one of these should be blamed and given up. But then the question is, which one and why? So, should we give up P2? But sentence one just is the expanded form sentence one is not true. This looks obvious on inspection, given the way the case was set up, and appears pretty much incontrovertible, right? It's not clear what it would take to prove that it's impossible to have the kind of case we set up at the outset. I have to show it's a metaphysical impossibility to do the thing that I made as if to do in setting up the case. How could we deny that sentence one is sentence one is not true, given the way that case was set up? So given that it looks like that nothing's gone wrong in setting up the case, attention typically focuses on the other premise involving application of the T-schema, because that looks like it's the other main operative element. So here the claim is sentence one is not true is true if and only if sentence one is not true, right? Application of this platitude about truth. So this appears to be written into platitudes about truth, even if we reject the deflationist view that endorsement of those platitudes constitutes our grasp on the meaning or concept of truth. Natural to think that, you know, whether or not one believes deflationism, one at least believes the platitudes. So it's not straightforward to see what could justify giving up this particular application of platitudes. Moreover, relatedly, it's hard to understand how any instance of the T-schema could end up false. Okay? If blaming this thing involves seeing it to be false, it's hard to see how we could claim that this application of the T-schema comes out false. So what you've got is instances of sentence S is true if and only if S. Biconditional, in order for that biconditional to have a false instance, would need a case where minimally, like one side's true and the other side's false. So either we'd have that the S is true bit is true while S is false. So grass is green is true, but it's not the case that grass is green. Or we have S is true is false and S is true. So grass is green, all right. Nonetheless, the sentence grass is green is false. So it's difficult to see what could lead us into accepting those results. So it's hard to see how we can say that this application of the T-schema delivers up a falsehood. Okay, it's difficult. Yeah?
If our T-schema is based on propositions rather than sentences, perhaps it's not so simple to just construct a proposition like that.
I think that's absolutely right, and we'll get on to it. So one thing one will consider ending up doing here is moving to a propositional requirement on applications of the sentential T schema and seeing how that goes. So I think that's absolutely right.
But on the face of it, not straightforward to see how to avoid this. And note that on that style of view, it'd be delicate how to put it. Like, you wouldn't say that this was false or an instance of this was false. You'd say something like it's a truth value gap, fails to express a proposition or what have you. Good. Okay. So, what to do? Well, one thought here is that there's nothing much to be done. Okay, so one thought here is that what's just been revealed to us by working through these forms of the liar paradox is that the concept of truth that we ordinarily make use of is incoherent. Okay? Concept of truth that we ordinarily employ is incoherent. So the idea here is, and this again would kind of fit minimalism modulo these issues about propositions, premise one, the notion of truth as we ordinarily understand it requires all instances of the T-schema to be true or acceptable. Premise two, but the liar shows that that very requirement, as built into our concept of truth leads to inconsistency, right? Leads us to accepting the very same claim as true and false. Hence, the ordinary notion of truth is incoherent, imposes on us inconsistent demands. So that's one kind of so-called lesson of the liar. And at least at some times, it's the lesson that Alfred Tarski draws from Reflection on the Liar. So he says, a characteristic feature of colloquial language, in contrast to various scientific languages, is its universality. It would not be in harmony with the spirit of this language if in some other language a word occurred which could not be translated into it. It could be claimed that if we can speak meaningfully about anything at all, we can also speak about it in colloquial language. So anything you can say in plain speak or something. If we're to maintain this universality of everyday language in connection with semantical investigations, so investigations into things like truth, we must, to be consistent, admit into the language, in addition to its sentences and other expressions, also the names of these sentences and expressions, and sentences containing these names, as well as such semantic expressions as true sentence, name, denote, and so forth. But it's presumably just this universality of everyday language which is the primary source of all the semantical antinomies, like the antinomies of the liar or of heterological words. These antinomies seem to provide a proof that every language which is universal in the above sense, and for which the normal laws of logic hold, must be inconsistent. Right, so Tarski's in effect blaming the facts that were involved in constructing the paradox, leading to the paradox. What were those facts? Well, one was that we have a language that's able to talk about bits of itself. Right, we have this sentence that made reference to a sentence, namely itself. Right, it's hard to see why that could, what could block that. Looks like ordinary language ought to be able to do that. And in addition, we have a range of concepts, including concepts of truth and the like, that we can use in application to these sentences, including this very sentence itself. So he says, if we analyse the antinomy of the liar, we reach the conviction that no consistent language can exist for which the usual laws of logic hold, and which at the same time satisfies the following conditions. Okay, and then spells out these conditions of universality in more detail. If these observations are correct, the very possibility of a consistent use of the expression true sentence, which is in harmony with the laws of logic and the spirit of everyday language, seems very questionable. Right? Put more briefly, there's no way of dealing with the liar paradox. Right? Insofar as it applies to natural language, ordinary language uses of is true, it shows that those languages are completely incoherent. So, on Tarski's view, any universal language, any language able to refer to its own sentences and to apply is true uniformly to all and any sentences, is paradox susceptible. With respect to any such language, it will be possible to generate an instance of the liar paradox. And next time, we'll start looking at what Tarski's response to that difficulty is, right, over and above despair. Thank you.